I'm going to be very brief because I think all of you, Mike Hutt knows this for at least 20 years, if not longer, but my specialism is 14th century Islam, so I can't possibly say too much at the moment. But I'm delighted to welcome all of you. And what I did want to say was that I wanted to say how we brought this event together and the importance that it has for us at the South Asia Center. Which I can't proceed without thanking our two graduate students, Charlotte Ramble and Yvonne Deschenaux, and my colleague, Shema Bajer, who is at the right over there, because we all came together at some point earlier this year to decide that we must do something which is of topical interest and concerning contemporary Nepal. And I'm delighted that at fairly short notice we have been able to put it together. This event is in a series of events that we have been doing, but they have just not been consistent enough. Please do visit our website and see our countries page and look at Nepal to see all the events, including my trip to Kathmandu a couple of years ago. We have a very, for those of you who might be interested, we have a very alive alumni association based in Kathmandu. And I would like to especially thank His Excellency, Dr. Subedi, who is Ambassador of Nepal to the United Kingdom, for his support. He has come whenever we have invited and requested him to come, and today as well. He has come because we had problems with scheduling, so we had to change timing, so I'm especially grateful. I'm also grateful to all my speakers on both my sides who have come from various distances and from various preoccupations. When we decided to do this event, we did an earlier event where Mike and Mara were there on the Constitution, which was done by the student group. What we actually wanted to do was that we wanted to discuss the concept of secularism. This was the focus of our attention and our interest, and we wanted to discuss it in the context of Nepal, on the understanding that of a lot of things that we have been doing with regards to various other countries in South Asia, including Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and India. And we are also going to have a Bangladesh summit on the 5th of June over here, is to take one country, take an important concept or issue, and see its contextual relevance and importance, but also see its applied relevance and importance across the region. And Nepal provided a fantastic provision for that, through talking about and discussing the idea of secularism in Nepal today from multiple perspectives of the various experts and their backgrounds, their disciplinary backgrounds. I should mention that we are planning another event in Michaelmas term, and we will be in touch again, so please do be on the lookout. And I don't know if we're going to, are we going to circulate the sign-up sheets?
Yes.
Okay, so please do, if you're not on our mailing list, please do sign up to these so that we can keep you informed. The way we've planned this event is that after Dr. Subedi speaks, which will be for roughly 10 minutes, I have sent an email ahead of time to all the speakers, to speak for 10 minutes each on the idea, the concept of secularism, from their perspective, from their disciplinary, as well as their expert perspective. For the convenience of those who may not know about this already, we have also put up a link to the Nepal Constitution on our Nepal country page, where you can actually go and look at what the text actually says about the introduction of that concept, which is very, very important. Everyone speaks for 10 minutes. David has very kindly agreed to begin the conversation and the presentations. David Gellner, he is currently Professor of Social Anthropology and Chair of the School of Anthropology and Museum Ethnography at the University of Oxford. He's to my left. Next to Dr. Subedi is Dr. Sondra Hasner, who is Professor of Anthropology of Religion at the University of Oxford. To the left of David is Marie Lecomte Tilouni, Did I get that right?
Tilouina.
Tilouina, okay. Algerian French, okay. Who is Director of Research at the CNRS in English, the French National Center for Scientific Research in Paris, and is a member of the Faculty of the Laboratory for Social Anthropology. A special word of thanks to Marie, because we were actually not able to cover her entire costs for making this travel, but she has agreed to share the cost, so we're very grateful to her for being here. And to Professor Sandra Hauser's right is Mara Malagudi, who is currently Senior Lecturer in Law at City University here in London. These are our speakers. They will all speak for 10 minutes in this order, one after the other, without any interruptions. Okay. I have then requested Michael Hutt, who's Professor of Nepali and Himalayan Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, which is my alma mater, to comment on the various points that our speakers will make. Yeah? We'll then have a moderated discussion amongst the speakers, depending on the issues that have been raised, and open it up for then to all of you to have a discussion, to take it forward. We must finish by 8 o'clock. Okay, on that note, Your Excellency, if you stop, you can sit here and speak. That should be fine.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair of the program, Dr. Nilanjan Sarkar, distinguished guests, speakers, friends, ladies and gentlemen, namaste and good evening. It is my immense pleasure and honor to be here among the renowned and respected academic personalities, and I must say, well-wisher of Nepal and the Nepalese people, I wish to express my sincere thankfulness to the LSE South Asia Center, particularly my good friend, Dr. Sarkar, for hosting such a significant academic gathering focusing on my country, Nepal. The collective presence of the eminent luminaries today not only symbolizes the importance of the gathering, but also demonstrates the affection of the LSE on Nepal and the Nepalese people. And I saw several students from Nepal. It's my pleasure to meet the students from Nepal also this evening. I was little hesitating when I was informed the theme of today's roundtable discussion, from Hindu kingdom to a secular state. The words Hindu kingdom embodied in the theme of today have become history in Nepal. Nepal had undergone historical political development, or I can say historical political transformation, when the Nepalese people declared the country a federal democratic republican and secular state. Therefore, digging the graveyards for picking up the bones of a dead body would not be worth exercise. You all friends know that Nepal remained ever independent, even in the heyday of colonialism, but was fallen prey to both the natural and man-made disasters. Moreover, if the tenacity in the history of Nepal has helped it to maintain its freedom, the constraints of geography, on the contrary, have added to the difficulties. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, the Nepalese people achieved several tangible achievements, but I mention particularly four tangible achievements in the last one decade and a half. Firstly, the Nepalese people restored peace in the country through a homegrown peace process, which is, I must say, unique and exemplary to the rest of the world. Secondly, the Nepalese people declared Nepal a republic from a traditional monarchical system. Thirdly, the people of Nepal adopted secularism, renouncing a deeply rooted dominance of Hinduism in the country. Fourthly and finally, the Nepalese people have institutionalized a move from a unitary to federal system of governance. These four achievements are intertwined and complementing to each other. Perhaps it can fairly be assumed that Nepal has had its society deeply rooted in traditional culture, which is still struggling to preserve its identity in the international arena and seeking for, at the same time, ways of improving the life of its people. In our all efforts, poverty comes on the way as the main obstacle. Together, the increasing adverse effects of rampant poverty and frequent changes in the government, which often obstruct the aspiration of our people and diminish our achievements. Against this backdrop, our goal of sustained economic growth and sustainable development growth has become all the more challenging. The Right Honourable Prime Minister, who has assumed his office of High Office of Prime Minister some 3 months and a half ago, has clearly stated that promoting the image of Nepal as an inclusive democratic state at the international level and advancing the cause of Nepal's socio-economic development would be the two intrinsic goals of the government. After the formation of a stable government, which commands two-thirds of majority in the parliament and which would, I must say, last for a full 5 years term, unlike previous governments over the last 15 and 20 years, the development agenda has now come to the fore with the hope and confidence of better and brighter future of the Nepalese people. The present government has the motto that I believe you heard, the motto of prosperous Nepal and happy Nepali, which would be founded on 6 fundamental pillars, namely nationalism, commitment to multi-party parliamentary democracy and fundamental freedoms, social justice, good governance, stability, progress and development, and the end of protracted political transition in the country. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, yes, we are talking about secularism in Nepal. I must mention about the Constitution of Nepal, which was promulgated in 2015, September. This constitution has clearly stated that Nepal is an independent, indivisible, sovereign, secular, inclusive, federal, democratic, republican state. The constitution has also mentioned that Nepal is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural, and multilingual country. Although it has only 30 million population, Nepal has 125 ethnic groups and 123 spoken languages. It symbolizes the rich, diverse, vibrant, and coexisting culture of the country. The Nepalese people have recognized and realized our culture, civilization, and identity as our assets. The Nepalese culture is germinated and developed in Nepal at the beginning of the first century or even earlier. What the old people find as Nepalese culture today, like a spectrum of a vibrant cultural rainbow in Nepal, made in the multitude of religions, religious and cultural faiths, religious and cultural festivals and rituals. But the old people were able to witness the grandeur and opulence of Nepalese culture only after Nepal opened to the outside world with the advent of democracy in 1951. Although different ruling dynasties patronized, preserved, and promoted Nepal's culture, in essence, Nepal's culture is a people's culture, a culture nurtured by the people through the ages. every cultural event takes place in Nepal with the participation of the mass people. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes some institutions and individuals raise unwarranted and unnecessary issues and questions on Nepal's commitment on the human rights and the religious freedom. They apparently seem a prejudiced mindset and a biasness in their expressions. The report of the European Union Election Observation Mission on the election of the House of Representatives and Provincial Assemblies held in November and December 2017 is an ample example of such prejudiced opinion. The government of Nepal has issued a press release stated that the report had made unwarranted comments about political issues that have already been settled and called upon all the concerned to refrain from making such uncalled for comments. It has further stated that the Constitution of Nepal was promulgated in line with the inclusive policy reflective of Nepalese social and cultural structure. In fact, friends, ladies and gentlemen, in fact, we not only constitutionally and legally, but also by heart, respect equally all the religions and religious faiths. Our culture of coexistence, tolerance, and harmony is embedded in our soil and embodied in our hearts. The fact is that we may be poor and hungry, but we don't want bread from anybody. Rather, we want them to teach us how to prepare bread. In fact, we have to learn to survive on our own feet. Albert Einstein had once said, I quote, "I am thankful to all those who said no. Because of them, I did it myself." Friends, ladies and gentlemen, I also wish to mention a bit loudly and clearly that the Constitution of Nepal has declared the country as a secular state, which has embodied the provision of right to equality, stating that no discrimination shall be made in the application of general laws, and the state shall not discriminate citizens on grounds of origin, religion, race, caste, tribe, sex, economic condition, language, region, ideology, or on other similar grounds. The Constitution had enshrined a clear provision of right to freedom of religion, saying that every person who has faith in religion shall have the freedom to profess, practice, and protect his or her religion according to his or her conviction. The Constitution of Nepal has maintained that no one is allowed to convert another person from one religion to another, or any act or conduct that may jeopardize other's religion, and such act is punishable by law. Today, we'll be delighted to listen to interesting and insightful presentation by Professor Gellner, Professor Hosner, if I pronounce correctly, Dr. Mala Gowdy, and Miss Mary Tilowin. I'm correct?
Yes.
And we will be delighted to listen the invaluable comments by Professor Michael Hutt. I thank them in advance for their invaluable views and opinions, which would, I believe, be inspirational and instrumental for making future course of the policies of the government of Nepal. Having said these few words of greetings and good wishes, I wish the program a great success. I thank you all.
Thank you very much. David?
Right, well, thank you, Your Excellency, for starting us off so well. I feel obliged to just add a couple of comments to what you've said before I go into my prepared remarks. I absolutely completely agree that about your four achievements of peace, republicanism, secularism, and federalism. I think that is an astonishing achievement of Nepal in the last 15 years. And all you have to do is compare it to this country, where we have neither a republic nor secularism. We still have bishops in the House of Lords, nor a proper systematic system of federalism. The F word is in fact completely taboo in this country, even though we have a partial federalism. But you know, as always in this country, it's all
no constitution
at all. We do have a peace process, but astonishingly, we seem to be on the point of actually throwing that in the bin. Completely astonishing that the political class should be even thinking about that. So my Nepali friends often think, you know, when they're complaining about how terrible everything is, I say, at least you've managed to get rid of your monarchy. And they think I'm joking when I say that. I think we do have a lot to discuss. I apologise now, but I feel I cannot but start with a commercial break, because this whole topic is very heavily covered in this book that I edited with Sondra and also with Chiara Letizia. And I must say, in a sense, having this discussion today without Chiara present is a little bit like Hamlet without the prince. This grew out of her. It was her project that it grew out of. She is the one who has done systematic ethnographic work on what secularism actually means to people in the Kathmandu Valley and in the Terai, and she's also analysed relevant court cases, which I don't think any of us present have done. I just want to sort of put that on record. The book grew out of a wonderful conference that Sondra and I organised in 2012, so quite a long time ago now. Serendipitously, it took us so long to edit the book that we were able to actually incorporate the appearance of the new constitution, which I think greatly strengthened the book. Also another serendipitous contribution is that Rajiv Bhargava, who is the preeminent political philosopher of secularism in India, by chance happens to be an old friend of mine. We studied at Balliol together in the 1970s, and so I was able to persuade him to contribute contribute afterwards. And I thought, you know, as normally happens when people get asked to write an afterward, you'll get a kind of very, you know, fairly perfunctory three or four pages. But no, he actually took this commission incredibly seriously. He got hold of the then unofficial translation of the new constitution. The chapter is really long, and he really worked hard at it to try and incorporate the Nepalese experience into his more global theories about secularism. So it really adds value in a way that afterwards normally do not. And it also puts the Nepalese case in, you know, in stark comparison with India and with other forms of secularism. So final part of the commercial break. It will shortly be out in paperback at less than half the price of the hardback. I think 695 rupees Indian. So available in all good bookshops soon. So as the ambassador mentioned, the clause 4 of the constitution defines Nepal as you all know, using all these complex terms. It must be the kind of longest definition ever: independent, indivisible, sovereign, secular, inclusive, democratic, social, and ordered, federal, democratic, republican, state. And of all those terms, the only one that the Constitution thinks necessary to define is, yes, you've guessed it, secularism. So it seems apparently what socialism-oriented means, what federal means, and what inclusive means, all crystal clear. The one which is not crystal clear is the word secularism. And that has to be defined. And it's now officially defined as, for the purposes of this article, secular means religious, cultural freedoms, including protection of religion, cultural, handed down from time immemorial. Now, that doesn't really make a fantastic amount of sense in English, and I think the translation that we offer in the footnote on page 5 of our introduction actually reads slightly better in English. For the purposes of this clause, secular is to be understood to mean religious and cultural freedom, along with, or including, the protection of religion and customs practiced from ancient times. So some might say this is a kind of very Orwellian definition of secularism in terms of its exact opposite. That is to say, a secular state has to protect religion. Not just all religion, but specific kinds of religion, namely that type of religion which happens to have been there from ancient times. And so what does that mean? That means, and presumably this is still has to be tested in the courts, it means that the state can continue, the constitution legitimates the state to continue to support the traditional religions of Nepal, that is to say primarily Hinduism but also Buddhism, and I venture to guess that possibly Kiranti Dharma might also apply for support under that rubric. But of course it means that the state should not support non-ancient religions, read Christianity and Islam. So that contradicts one understanding, but I stress one understanding of what secularism should mean. And as the ambassador also said, the constitution guarantees the right to religious freedom, but at the same time bans conversion. Now, as you, most of you will probably know, the current government is about to introduce some quite restrictive guidelines for NGOs and INGOs operating in Nepal. And one of the rules, one of the many rules that they're intending to apply, is that anybody, you know, no NGO may operate or do anything that would disturb harmony or traditional culture. So they could lose their registration and lose their ability to operate. And what this reflects, as far as I understand it, is a kind of moral panic in the Nepalese middle class about Nepalis converting to Christianity. Now, I have to say, all the ethnographic evidence is that it's actually the conversions to Christianity are not being driven by foreign missionaries coming in and giving people money to convert. On the contrary, it is Nepalis themselves who are running the churches, and it is Nepalis themselves who are proselytizing, if you like, or who are acting as witness to the gospel and giving people the opportunity to convert. And that it, Nepalis themselves, ordinary poor Nepalis, have plenty of agency themselves. They're perfectly able to decide whether or not to convert. It's not a question of evil foreigners coming in and persuading them to do so. And those middle-class Hindu Nepalis who are so worried about this issue, I think would do much better to concern themselves not with foreign interference, but actually ask themselves about structural discrimination, about ask themselves whether Dalits and Janajatis have actually had a fair deal from the state and from Hinduism as it has been institutionalised in their country. Just to wrap up, I mean, clearly secularism is, in one sense, a Western concept, but Rajiv Bhargava has worked long and hard to look for earlier models or kind of parallels, if you like, for South Asian kind of antecedents for what his theory of Indian, what he calls principled distance. So the idea in his theory is not that the state should have nothing to do with religion, but that the state should itself not have a religion, but it should be able to support religions. And what's more, by the principle of the idea of principled distance, he's signalling the fact that the Indian state provides different kinds of support and different kinds of control to different religions. They don't have to treat all religions the same. They can treat them equally, even if they treat them differently. A principle of kind of equal respect, if you like. Of course, that whole ideology of Indian principled distance is under heavy threat in India today. Finally, we must, in discussing secularism in Nepal, we have to distinguish the process that people call secularization, sociologists call secularization, that's to say the gradual removal of religion from certainly from public life, or the decline in importance and influence of religious institutions from the political principle of secularism, which is really what we're discussing today, as I understand it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Professor Huston?
Thank you so much, and thank you for organizing the panel, and also for the invitation to be here. It's given an opportunity to really think through this rapidly changing terrain. So I took my remit here to think about what does Hinduism look like in a secular Nepal or in a becoming secular Nepal? Where is Hinduism now in this frame? And I'm going to follow on from David's comments pretty directly by looking at these questions in a national, in a regional, and in a global perspective, not necessarily in that order, but mixing them up a bit, because I think we need to move through those different frames in order to see what's going on in Nepal, but in context also. So first, secularism. Clearly Nepal is a special case, but as David just mentioned, the South Asian, more broadly, understanding of secularism is not that of the definition we have of secularism in the West. And as David mentioned, Rajiv Bhargava has written about this. Chiara Letizia, our colleague, has done great ethnographic work. But I'm also thinking of Christophe Jaffrelot, who's worked specifically in India, and of course older sociologists T.M. Madan and psychoanalyst Ashish Nandi. In the West, we think of secularism as not religion or non-religious, or the separation in classic American terms between church and state. In South Asia, broadly speaking, of course Nepal is a specific variant on this, but I still think the regional frame helps us, secularism actually means multi-religious, where all religions have equal or something close to equal status. So we have non-religion on one hand and multi-religion on another. And what does multi-religion mean then in the South Asian regional understanding of secularism? Well, in the Indian context at least, it means not promoting a majority religion, but it also means not promoting a minority religion. Equally, and this is definitely the case now even in the Nepali constitution, it means protecting minority religions so that citizenship rights are in some sense not dependent on religious status or religious practice. Now, interestingly enough, it's worth mentioning that the Indian constitution did not mention secularism explicitly in the 1950 constitution. It didn't actually appear as a word, from what I understand, until the 1976 constitution. But the principle of secularism, that your religious affiliation would not count against your citizenship rights, was there from the beginning and very clearly. And interestingly enough, even Jinnah wanted this in Pakistan until he died in 1948, before Pakistan then became a formally Islamic state. But Jinnah wanted it, wanted Pakistan to be a secular state that protected citizenship rights. Although Pakistan, of course, did not go that way. All right, so in a nutshell, that's secularism at these different levels. Second, Hinduism. I think it's very important that we put on the table clearly and explicitly that the politics of Hinduism, nationally, regionally, globally, should not be confused or conflated with the practices of Hinduism on the ground, how people are practicing their religious lives or even identifying religiously is related to, but not the same as, the way Hinduism, or indeed any religion, is being played out in political frames within nations and across them. So, on the politics of Hinduism in South Asia, and in Nepal specifically, I think it must be said outright, India, the right-wing political majoritarian movements of India, care about Nepal's history as a Hindu state. The fact that there was a state with a national identity that included a Hindu religious name mattered greatly to Hindu majoritarian movements in India. And those movements are still involved in Nepali politics today. The VHP has had an office up on the top of Pashupatinath Hill for many decades, and this is why we see these movements happening very actively in the Terai, etc. However, moving to Nepal, the national level specifically, I think it's important to remember that at least before 2001, before Ganendra took over, that the practices of even those who identified as Hindu in Nepal were famously, notably, visibly eclectic. It's what anthropologists might have in an earlier period called syncretic. It's what some sociologists, as I said, might call eclectic. The idea that your practices might be called Hindu, but incorporate elements of Buddhism, incorporate elements of Kiranti Dharma, incorporate regional elements was always the case. Just because you were counted as Hindu in the census didn't mean that your practices were exclusively, only, deliberately, consciously Hindu as such. And that eclectic range of practice is precisely at odds with the politics of Hinduism that we're seeing play out across the Nepal-India border. We can go into the details of what that looked like, and we can go into the details of why and when that started to change if we want, but I do think that that particular national configuration of what it meant to be involved in eclectic religion shouldn't be forgotten when we're considering Nepal specifically. So, finally then, what does Hinduism look like in this newly secular context? At the national level, we have a history of multiplicity of practices, and more recently, in the last decade, we have that happening against a regional discussion, a legal political discourse of multiplicity of identity categories. And this is budding against an attempt to define a nation through history and tradition that comes with a set of entrenched power relationships. So in a way, we are seeing, although very specifically in a Nepali context, we are seeing a very global debate playing out where we have multiculturalism or pluralism on one hand versus majoritarianism on the other, taking place against or within a national identity or frame that also depends on transnational movements. And Hinduism is the identity category through which this debate is playing out. Let me run through that again. On one hand, you have a very pluralist, legalist ethos in South Asia versus a kind of what I would call a right-wing majoritarianism, which wants Hinduism to be dominant in India, and also in conversation with certain groups in Nepal. And this is happening as a way of articulating Nepali identities in a vein or in a discourse that's taking Hinduism as a religion with a capital R as a category of identity that somehow needs to be represented in the census and needs to be represented as the way Nepali tradition has been understood. So, in a nutshell, that's sort of an overview or a theoretical understanding of secularism, Hinduism, and what Hinduism looks like in contemporary Nepal. And I want to end with just two, to my mind, open-ended questions that come out of these intersections, if I can call them that, these convergences at these different levels. First, will it remain true that practices stay significantly separate from politics? Will people continue to be able to practice in a multiple, inclusive, eclectic way, as they always have been in Nepal, I would suggest, with the politics taking on a stronger and stronger valence? The example I'm thinking of here is the obvious growth of the bhajan around Aarti, which is becoming symbolically this visible oral representation of Hindu practice across Indian pilgrimage sites. I'm now starting to see it in Kathmandu. At Pashupatinath at dusk is now Aarti played as well. And as I was doing fieldwork in Dolaka, in Khaski, I was hearing Anuradha Padel, who sings that famous Aarti bhajan, on the tape recorder playing throughout. So there's a sense in which the practices of Hinduism are becoming more monolithic, perhaps, or supposed to converge around this identity category that is Hinduism as such. And in that way, it almost seems like Hinduism is becoming more monolithic in a global frame. On the other hand, I'm going to end also where David ended, on the sociological understanding of secularization, which was a 1960s term in the West, which looked at the way religion was receding from public life. And Brian Wilson, the sociologist in the 1960s, suggested that religion actually was coming out of the public sphere and moving into the private sphere. And consonant with that was also the possibility that it was gendered, it was becoming more female domain. The public governmental sphere remained male, the private domestic sphere of personal piety and religion was overwhelmingly female. And those are perhaps strains we've seen in Western sociological thought. I would suggest that in the regional context in South Asia, we're seeing the exact opposite now. We're seeing religion go from being a question of familial or personal or private or cool or guti level practice into the public sphere, into the political sphere. And I would also see that it's being masculinized as a result. It's become a public forum through which the masculine politics of Hinduism are being fought out and fought and fought. Thank you, Anjan.
Thank you. Marie?
So I was asked to speak about the Maoist and secularism using my ethnography. I will therefore focus on the revolutionary decade and on the question of secularism within the society or social secularism. After 2002, the Maoist party was strong enough in the hills of western and far western Nepal to lead a cultural revolution, aiming at creating a new society. Their fight for the destruction of the old values was therefore led in regions where the population was almost entirely Hindu, and hence targeted essentially the Hindu religion. The Maoist endeavor was complex, given that Hinduism is a religion without church, clergy, and even lacking a defined body of text. They thus had to target the practices, both collective and individual. Until now, it is not clear whether their actions against religious practices were spontaneous initiative of Maoist cadres, or if they were encouraged by the Politburo, which was very silent on the subject. Yet, the similarity of the Maoist actions in different places suggests that there was some form of coordination. Most of the collective Hindu rituals were forbidden in these regions. Some, such as Tej, the women's festival, on the ground that it was immoral and celebrating polygamous rishis, bringing a strikingly new picture of these most holy characters. But the ban, which had the most important socio-political consequences, was the one on the national festival of Dasain. Indeed, at this occasion, the whole Nepalese society was consecrated as a gigantic socio-political pyramidal structure headed by the king. In particular, it was, and still is, now that the festival has resumed, the occasion to reconfirm all the political positions, starting with the kings, but also the roles of each caste and within them of each person's position within the patrilineage and the family. It was also a time when the stigmatization of the untouchables and their association with impure evil forces was displayed. The ban on Dasein was facilitated by the general stupor provoked by the Royal Palace massacre in June 2001, and the fact that the new king had a negative image. Yet, if the kings used to play a pivotal role in the caste organization, the latter may function without supreme power, based on control of individual behavior within each group, from fear to be contaminated, the caste organization may be likened to a society of control of all by all, a panoptic organization in the open air, which punishes by exclusion. Although it may have taken a stricter form in Nepal because of its inclusion in the law and its supervision by the king, it is not strictly related to the legal and political institutions, since it functions well in spite of the law and without king in India and now in Nepal. So the Maoists developed as a mobile collective strictly opposite to the caste society, that is, a collective promoting equality between caste and between genders. They presented themselves as new men and as a model of society meant to spread by imitation. But in parallel, they also targeted and punished what they called social crimes, mainly religious discrimination against the untouchables and women. they led numerous campaigns to end untouchability, during which they not only made discourses, but also put them into practice by offering food cooked by untouchable to all the pure caste. And those who refused to eat the so-called polluted food were forcibly fed, or sometimes fed with cow meat, or even, in a strict reversal of the Dharma, treated as animals, as jantu, as opposed to people, janta, and tied in their shed until they changed their mind. Interestingly, this seclusion in the shed is strongly reminiscent of another major religious discrimination against which the Maoists led their struggle, that of women. And to understand the scope of the latter, it is necessary to say a few words on the social organization in Nepal. In this context, where caste councils are unknown, caste rules have always been regulated by each patrilineage. The functioning of these units, which form the nucleus of the Nepalese caste organization, is thus fundamental. And all these patrilineages submit women to a specific treatment, namely their deterritorialization and their devitalization, which is far from being Hindu-specific and which have not been challenged in the so-called secular Nepal. Indeed, Nepalese women are bound to mobility. Their residence, their identity, and their status change at the time of their wedding. A ceremony itself considered as a gift is not as a kind of sacrifice from the part of their father. When they die, Hindu women's death rituals are shaped as a repetition and as a completion of their wedding. Somehow, women are thus twice dead on the model of high caste males who are twice born. Hindu women have another speciality, that of being degraded at the bottom of the social ladder during their periods. They then become untouchable regardless of their caste. They can no longer enter temples or houses, nor engage in any activity requiring purity, such as cooking, carrying water, or milking the animals. In far western Nepal, they can even not eat butter or buffalo milk, lest the buffalo sickens and stops milking. And they have to stand in small huts specifically designed for their periods. Though it is temporary, exclusion of women is stronger than that of the untouchables. They are indeed banned from their own domestic unit and are not supposed to pollute even the sun. The caste organization, therefore, not only rests upon impure groups taking in charge the impure task, but also on submitting women to perpetual deterritorialization in opposition to their firmly theorized male counterparts. Women's social and spatial mobility goes together with a deprivation of identity, of autonomy, and even of vitality, which is more generally the effect of power on the individual. Consistent with such a situation, women are legally deprived of autonomy by not being entitled to receive a share of their father's heritage in today's Nepal. All this contributed to give women a nomadic potential, which was suddenly revealed by the Maoist movement when thousands of girls joined the movement. But in the same manner that the Maoist method to end caste discrimination was to pollute everybody, turning everybody into untouchables, the Maoists were able to end gender discrimination only within the global deterioration imposed on their group, with the whole party in finally a female-like mobile position. Indeed, though they tried to persuade villagers to stop, for instance, menstrual discrimination, and though they organized new collective forms of marriage, their actions had a very limited effect outside their own group. And we may think that the mobilizing techniques of the Maoist, which consisted in making people mobile, literally, was in fact rightly chosen. Indeed, we heard, of course, first of policemen and militaries once defeated who were taken away from for some days by the Maoists for a special cooling. Though this translation, through this translation, they were made to experience the Maoist way of life and adopt their perspective. But this technique of subtraction was used massively in rural Nepal, where hundreds of teenagers were abducted daily by the Maoists on the pretext of giving them a dance or music training, and during which they would experiment another way of life, which attracted many among them. The Maoists even took away entire villages to attend their meetings, setting people in motion towards their own antithetic universe revealed in colorful cultural shows. They had a very strong effect on the population then, the population which was not only put outside their own territory and their norms, but also made to take side with the revolutionaries by this simple displacement, nothing distinguishing a Maoist from their involuntary guest in the eyes of the armed forces. In one word, the Maoists considered that religious ideas were rooted in social practices and that the Cultural Revolution was the most important. It had major effect, but in the first place, on the members of the party, and for a limited period of time, while they were living in utopia, that is, in perpetual mobility. Yet, I consider that they had important lasting effects outside their party on the peoples in each settlement, namely in ending polygamy, reducing violence related to intercaste marriages, discrimination among the Dalits themselves, and in introducing a minimal commensality among all castes in many hilly regions in the form of a cup of tea, which is not commonly accepted from all. So,
thank you. Mara.
Thank you so much, Lynn and Jennifer, and Agnes Vander, for having me here. It's always lovely to come back to the LSE. So today I would like to offer a few reflections on the place of secularism in Nepal's current 2015 constitution. So I propose to look at two functions that the constitution fulfills. And to do that from my disciplinary perspective as a comparative constitutional lawyer and a constitutional historian. So first of all, we have the structuring function of the Constitution, which really tells us how does secularism frame the relationship between the state and religion under the new 2015 document. Secondly, I think the question we need to ask is how does secularism fit within the broader foundational function of the Constitution? So how does the new 2015 document construe a collective sense of the political community that inhabits Nepal? Meaning, how does the definition of the state as secular contribute to the formation of this idea of we, the people of Nepal? So the argument that I put to you today is that these constitutional functions are closely interrelated and need to be investigated in a historical perspective. So actually, I'm going to start from the second function and offer some thoughts on the symbolism and of this transition from Hindu kingdom to secularism. So to frame that in terms of constitutional history, the definition of the state of Nepal included a feature of the Hindu kingdom since the 1962 Panchayat constitution. We had that in the 1990 constitution, and then the big break actually took place in 2007 with the interim constitution. And then, of course, we move on to a definition of the state under Article 4 of the current constitution. And I wanted to pick up on David's point about that pesky little clause, which is the explanation.
Here, under my hat as lawyer, I would like to remind everyone that the only authoritative version of the law in Nepal is in the Nepali language. So perhaps it is helpful to look at the way in which that clause is articulated in Nepali. And I guess the operative word is Sanatana Deki. So since time immemorial, and how that word is being translated. And I think if we just look at the English translation, perhaps we miss out on the genealogy of the term. So what I want to do for you is to contextualize that clause and look at the history of where it comes from. To be able to do that, we need to link this definition of religion to a number of other texts, not just the previous constitutions. We need to look at the 1953 Mulukiyen, the country code, and in my work on Nepali law, I find that actually a lot of what's going on in the constitutional text is understood in a better way from what's happening in the Mulukiyen. So, if we look at this definition of the Nepali state as secular, and then we link that to the explanation, well, first of all, I agree with David, it would be interesting to see how the courts will interpret that. But I think, you know, before the courts do that, I think we can speculate a little bit with regard to the meaning of the clause as it is. So, if we link that to the other article on the right to religion, which is Article 26 in the current constitution, religion is just defined as religion. But if we actually look back at the previous constitution, and I'm pushing you back to an even earlier one, which is the 1959 constitution, actually the definition of religion that we had consistently up to that point was a definition of religion as practiced since time immemorial, Sanatana Deki. So that's actually been a consistent feature of the previous rights to religion in the document. Where does that come from? I think actually the Mulukiyen has a clause that criminalizes religious interference, so that actually predates any of the constitution that I've been speaking about. And if you look at the original formulation that was amended later on in 1991, essentially, what do you have is that the definition of religion Sanatana Deki is the definition of Hinduism. Because specifically, that clause of the Mulukiyen forbade religious interference from the Christian and Muslim faith. In 1991, so a year after the 1990 constitution was promulgated, those references were taken out of the Mulukiyen. But I think that is quite indicative with what Sanatana Deki means in the legal context of Nepal. And that to me is interesting for a number of reasons. It's also interesting, and I think it's never defined in Nepali law, how is Hinduism conceptualized? What applies? Do we have the Omkar Parivar? So are practices under Buddhism, Sikhism, and Jainism included into that? And we could argue by looking at what's going on across the border with India, that's generally the definition that we have of the application of Hindu personal law. So I'm wondering whether a comparison would help us in the way in which that's construed. But of course, in terms of differences, Nepal doesn't have a system of personal laws. Actually, civil and criminal law are both run under a uniform code, which is the Mulukiyen. So, I'm just wondering whether and if the courts will interpret that, how that will play out. So that leads me to consider the relationship between the state and religion. And essentially, if we look at the history of this clause in light of the transition from Hindu kingdom to a secular federal republic, I think essentially what we have questions being raised about the role of Hinduism in the process of state formation of Nepal, in the process of nation building, of course the fact that Nepal was never colonized, so the idea that these elements were really important with regard to the foundational basis and the foundational function of the constitution. And then that kind of symbolism, in a way, continues to endure in the constitutional framework. I'm thinking about some more symbolical elements of the constitution, so we have Nepal is the only country in the world that has a national animal. I can tell you because we're working on a taxonomy on this. So, and of course it is the cow. So that remains as a form of Hindu symbolism. That goes along with the fact that also Nepal is the only country that has a national color, which is saffron. There's also national bird that has not any religious connotation, it's the Lophophorus. But the idea is that somehow that identity, in my view, has not been entirely discarded, it's been partly reformulated. So what we're seeing is some sort of transition. But from a legal point of view, to me, what's very clear is that the 2015 constitution takes a step back from the 2007 interim constitution, which essentially gave an unqualified constitutional definition of secularism. So, how that's going to play out in practice, that I don't know. I think we're going to see, we're going to wait and see how that develops. Happy to take a few more questions in the Q&A. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I have not had to check anyone for time. But thank you very much, everyone, for keeping to time. What we will do now is request Mike to comment. But if you have specific questions for anyone, if you just direct it to them, otherwise say what you want to, and then we can open up. Do you want to start?
Well, thank you. This is one of the more challenging moments of my academic career. This is the definition of thinking on one's feet. I have in front of me a very messy set of notes, and I'll try and make some sense of them and try and make them coherent and relate to what's being said. I think the first thing to say is that my reaction to the theme of today was somewhat similar to His Excellency's, in the sense that I thought, is this the main issue regarding the new Nepal constitution now, the secularism question? I've been currently, recent weeks, been looking at the relationship between actually the 2015 earthquake and the promulgation of the 2015 constitution, trying to evaluate the extent to which there's some kind of causal link between these two events, and if so, what kind of causal link might this be? And if you look at the debates that raged through the summer of 2015 in Nepal, secularism was not, I think, a major topic of those debates. It was particularly the number of provinces, the delineation of the provinces, and so on and so forth. And after the promulgation of the constitution, the kinds of controversies that then came up were more to do with those kinds of issues, and issues particularly of citizenship, than about the nature of the secular or religious or otherwise nature of the state. So I think if we were having a discussion about the controversial aspects of the 2015 constitution, I think the relationship between the state and Hinduism and religion more generally would certainly figure in the debate. It's not a non-issue, but it maybe is not the headline issue, at least out of the autumn of 2015. I'll just throw that out as a perhaps a slightly provocative kind of suggestion for you to think about. Also, I'd say that, I mean, I think picking up on something that Sondra said about the issue of whether Nepal is still a Hindu king, you know, where the place of Hinduism in the secular Nepal is perhaps a fairly larger perhaps in the Indian mind than perhaps in many Nepali minds, where, you know, the secularism of the Nepali state is already there in the 2007 interim constitution. So this is not a very new thing in the constitutional dispensation in Nepal. So that's point one. Point two was going to be one about how important it is to look at the original Nepali text when talking about constitutions, but my star ex-student, Mara, has stolen my thunder there, well-trained as she is. But I think just to add to that, there's this interesting question of what the translation should be of Nirapekshata, which is always translated as secularism, but when you go into it, is actually to do with, you know, kind of something like neutral on questions of religion. It's not an exact translation of secularism. And I think what's interesting looking at the differences between the 2007 interim constitution and the 2015 one is, as has been said several times, is there is this spashtikaran added. And spashtikaran is a clarification of what secularism means. And when we look at the Spashtikara, there isn't a Spashtikara in the 2007 constitution, as Mara pointed out. But there is the introduction in the 2015 constitution, not only of the Spashtikara and the clarification, but also of the word Sanatana, which is not there in the previous one. What the 2007 constitution says is Parapurvadeki Teliyaku. So Parapurva is kind of an entirely secular word, if you like. Whereas Sanatana, if we look at the definition of it in the Nepali Brihad Shabdakosh, the big dictionary, there's a long series of definitions of Sanatana, and it brings in, you know, towards the end of the possible definitions of Sanatana, you know, some Aryan deities and context and so on, which it doesn't bring in to Parapurva. So there is a more Hindu stroke Aryan flavour to the word Sanatana, although that is not its primary meaning than Parapurva. So a decision was taken to move in that direction a little bit in the wording of that Spashtikara as compared to 2007, which may or may not indicate something broader or more fundamental about the nature of the constitution. So I think perhaps His Excellency would comment on the word Sanatana and why it's there in the 2015 constitution and not the 2007, or anybody else who would like to think about that. The third thing I wanted to say was there's an interesting distinction, isn't there, between the wording of the constitution, about which we can get very finickety and pedantic and, you know, as I've just been doing, and Mara as well, which is important. Lawyers love this stuff. But there's also what actually happens in the society, in the country, which is more the anthropological kind of field. So we have both sides represented here on today's panel, which is great. So I suppose the other sort of comments and questions I had scribbled down here. What's the relationship between the move towards constitutional secularism and the identity politics that became such a big feature of Nepali political discourse from the early 90s onwards? And is there a relationship between the wording on secularism in the 2015 constitution and the fact that identity politics waned in the year or two, perhaps, before the promulgation of that constitution, due to the different composition of the membership of the second constituent assembly? So I'll leave that one. I don't know, maybe that's a David question. I'm not sure. And is there also any relationship, if we see an increased Kas Arya representation in the second CA, and also the drafting of the 2015 constitution, is that also in any way linked to the flavour of secularism we now see enshrined in the new constitution? Question perhaps for Sondra. What do you see as the direction of travel here? What is the intended or likely sort of destination of this tension between the multicultural on the one hand and the majoritarian on the other? Where are we going here? How much bearing does this constitutional stuff actually have on the what actually happens? What's the relationship between them? Is the constitutional? Sorry, I'm using the word stuff here, but I hope you know what I mean. is that driving what's actually happening in society, or is it in some way reflecting it? Question for Marie on the Maoists. Your work has been, for the last few years, in the far west of Nepal, which is a part of Nepal I've never been to, I have to confess, and is incredibly valuable as, you know, an in-depth ethnographic understanding of the society of that part of Nepal, which is much less visited by anthropologists and foreigners more generally. So it'd be very interesting to know to what extent what you were describing still has an impact on daily life in those far western societies of Nepal, Now that, you know, the conflict is over, peace has been restored, we have, you know, greater political stability, a constitution in place, and so on. Or has that, does that still continue to have an effect, or has it evaporated in many ways? And also, do you see much of a Maoist impact on the content of the new constitution? Or has the Maoist ideological impact on Nepal diminished considerably, particularly after the very poor showing the Maoists had in the second constituent assembly and the safe landing of their leaders in a more comfortable place? Final one, I think, is back to the title of today's discussion, Hindu Kingdom to Secular Republic. I think probably a question for Mara. Did earlier constitutions actually define Nepal as a Hindu kingdom, or did they say that the king of Nepal will be?
It was in 1962 until 1990 constitution it was mentioned, but from the interim constitution which was promulgated in 2007, from that.
But does it specifically say Nepal is a Hindu kingdom?
62 constitution it has clearly mentioned like it's a Hindu kingdom with Maharaja, Hindu Adiraja, like that.
Okay. I think that's the best I can do. So, back to the panel.
Mara knows more than me, she can.
Maybe we should take. Thank you very much. That was wonderful. Now, what we've agreed in deference to the ambassador's official position is that in certain places, if he would like to, he would speak. But otherwise, you know, it's probably not. Want to be put in a position where even if he has an opinion, he should probably not give it openly. But you have just offered to speak, so.
Thank you very much, Nilanjan. It's a wonderful presentation we listened to. And the very first comment, the preliminary preamble speech statement made by David was also a very interesting one. I wish to repeat the four tangible achievements or features of the political development of Nepal, which we achieved over the last decade and a half. Like I mentioned, restoration of peace, federalism, secularism, and republican state. These features are, I must mention again, intertwined and complementing to each other. There are issues I carefully noted down, but in a very general note, I would say some points. Mara has mentioned like this, we have traveled a long journey of constitution, like started from 1853's Jang Bahadur Rana's Muluki Ain to again another Rana Prime Minister Padma Shamsher also promulgated a constitution in 1947 also. And from 1958, the democratic constitution, which was led by the former Prime Minister B.P. Koirala, on the basis of that constitution, there was a parliamentary election also held. That 1958 constitution to 1962's partyless panchayat system constitution, which was promulgated by King Mahendra. And even until 90s democratic constitution, which has adopted multi-party parliamentary democracy as the cardinal principle of political system in Nepal, but Hinduism, the factor, Hindu factor was dominating still until 90. But the interim constitution, which was promulgated by not the Constituent Assembly, but the parliament under a committee, a constitution promulgation drafting committee, that interim constitution of 2007 and the present constitution which was promulgated in 2015 have, I must say, definitely ensured and safeguarded the principle of secularism. That I must say. There are words like Mara was translating. I also, when I was a student, I used to write literature, poetry and those things, but I am not very aware of Nepali Briyat Sabdakosh, that Professor Hart and Mara know, but I am not very aware of Nepali Briyat Sabdakosh. It's very big one, that's why it's Briyat Sabdakosh. But what you making interpretation or connotation or translation of the words Sanatan Dehi or Parapurva Kal Dehi, don't interpret in your eyes. What I mentioned in my previous statement, the Constitution has mentioned about the preservation of traditional culture, which has embodied our tolerance, non-violence, harmony, coexistence. These are features. That's our traditional culture. And the Constitution has maintained for the preservation of our that distinguished, unique traditional culture of the country. And I have already, as I have already stated, the Nepalese people, we have accepted and adopted this traditional culture, which is unique, diverse, coexisting. This culture, customs, traditions, and I must say our civilization is our assets that we cannot lose. My second point would be, yes, on the basis of Constitution, which was promulgated in 2015, the present Constitution, the government of Nepal has crafted and implemented the policy for the NGOs. You know, like when we were being suffered by the devastating earthquake, that time the YY noodles packet and some religious books were distributing together. So now, the government, on the basis of the Constitution, which was promulgated in 2015, carefully crafted and implemented the policy for INGOs and NGOs, suggesting them not to disturb harmony, our unity, our tolerance, and our coexistence. That's a government can do. It's on the basis of our Constitution. It does not, in any sense, harm the religious freedom or equality to the freedom of rights or freedom of religion. My third point would be the secularization of the country should not be interpreted as the freedom of conversion from one religion to another. That should not be interpreted. It's totally different. The reality is that everybody living in Nepal is free to profess and practice their religion, their religious faith, without any fear, threat, both constitutionally and legally. I must be loud and clear. Anybody living in Nepal or staying in Nepal is free to profess and practice his or her religious conviction and faith in Nepal. My fourth point, the newly constituted government in Nepal, the federal government, which is being led by Prime Minister Mr. Oli, and the seven provincial government, we have seven provinces, these governments and their policies and programs are being formulated and implemented on the basis of our new constitution. That is, I must say, democratic, inclusive, transparent, and secular. So we have drafted and promulgated our constitution on our own. Nobody has written our constitution. Sometimes you see, after the promulgation of constitution, there were incidents that you know. But this constitution is written by the Nepalese people written by the representative who were elected by the sovereign Nepalese people. So this constitution, in the sense, I disagree to the view expressed by Professor Hosner that if there is a Hindu nationalist party in the south or like BJP in India, and it has or it should have influence on Nepalese political parties or government of the, that I cannot agree, the representative of the government. Whichever party is in India or in China, it doesn't matter for us. We rule the country, we administer the country on the basis of our constitution, which was drafted and promulgated by the sovereign Constituent Assembly of Nepal in 2015, whom were elected by the Nepalese people. So these are the points. And finally, one point I would like to address respectfully to Professor Michael Hodge. Yes, secularism and identity politics, there could be, I can't say must be, but there could be some sort of link. But in Nepal, our indigenous movement, our movement of Dalit, marginalized people, downtrodden, marginalized people, or even Madhesi movement are not related to secularization or freedom of religion or those things. These are religious for their own rights. It's not related to secularization or conversion of religion or that. Not related. Any movement, either indigenous or Dalit, downtrodden or marginalized people, or even Madhesi movement in the Tarai Madhes of Nepal. It was not related to any religion or religious faith or conversion of religions. It was their movements were for their rights. That given by the constitution, and you know, more than 80% Nepalese people, they participated in the elections held for the local level elections, held for the 7 provincial level elections, and for the federal parliament also. So now Madhesi people are in government. The second number two province is led by the one of the major Madhesi party. We call Sanghiya Samajwadi Forum, or to translate it, Socialist Forum, Madhesi Forum in Nepal. Mr. Lal Babu Raut is chief minister, and all the Madhesi leaders, the prominent Madhesi leaders, have been elected for the House of Representatives. Started from Mahanta Thakur to Hridayesh Tripathi, Rajendra Mahato to Upendra Yadav. Everybody is in parliament. So everybody, starting from Himal to Tarai Madhes, there is no any question about the participation or participatory electoral system in Nepal. So I humbly request you, David and Chandra, when did you write this book? I think if you have written in 2012, you have to edit again. So please see Nepal, go Nepal now, everybody is in parliament. You see today also, our Right Honorable President was presenting the policy and programs of the present government. So you see the colorful faces, races, representing all the regions from Himal Pahad to Tarai Madhes. Everybody is in the parliament now. So no any question of participation in Nepal. Even small party, even one member, some parties have sent only one member in the parliament, but representation is there. Representation is there, and Madhesi, Dalit, indigenous, and women, I must say, our constitution has ensured minimum of 1/3 of representation in the constitution. I don't know, in Europe, European countries also there is or not, I have not read, maybe Mara can tell us, but the 1/3 of representation for women is guaranteed in the constitution for the federal parliament and the provincial assemblies in Nepal. and 40% of representation for the women is guaranteed for the local bodies in Nepal. So gender equality, women representation, and representation of indigenous minorities, Dalit, downtrodden, and other people. So it's a democratic, inclusive, transparent, secular constitution we have, and we have made it, we have drafted it, we have promulgated it through rigorous exercise of 8 years of exercise in Constituent Assembly. The first Constituent Assembly could not draft and promulgate the constitution, but the second Constituent Assembly was successful to promulgate the constitution for the Nepalese people. I thank you very much, but your views, your interesting, insightful views and opinions, I take it as your kind suggestion that I will convey, I will recommend to my parliament, to my government, to my people. I thank you. But last but not least, I must thank Dr. Nilanjan Sarkar, a good and close friend of mine, who is hosting such a wonderful debate. I must say it's a wonderful debate. So I wish to come to participate in such debate again in the future. I thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. You've done very well to fly the flag of Nepal just now. It's your job, you're paid for it, you get a salary for it. Okay. No, let me just say this. A few things. First, I think I should say as chair that I don't think Sondra was in any way suggesting that any kind of right-wing movement or party which is south of Nepal should have an influence. I think she was yes, but there's a difference between talking about an idea and presuming that is what it is. Likewise, I don't think Mike was in any way suggesting that what you replied to, but the fact of actually questioning whether or not identity politics and the coming of the constitution and the introduction of the concept of the secular in the constitution at a particular juncture could be thought about within the same framework. But I don't think there was any implicit accusation or suggestion in it. Having said that, thank you. Thank you very much. Now, we have a few questions from Mike. I have a few questions which I'm not asking, but one especially for you concerning Rajiv Bhargav, who in fact taught me at one time. Shall we take a few more, and then we can take clusters of questions, and then everyone can answer, and then we can keep moving on. If you can just introduce yourself before you ask questions.
I'm Boss. I'm a retired change management consultant in the city, an ex-teacher as well. I've got a couple of points. First of all, when I heard the discussion, I felt that we are worried about the Nepalese constitution from our perspective. I think it shouldn't be our concern how the constitution in Nepal is written. We should help adhere to it, to the constitution written by the Nepalese in their own context, not in the context that Europe or Britain thinks. And you can't say that you have to do this and that, because they have written, their representatives have endorsed and promulgated it. And I think we have to help them follow that constitution. And secondly, I agree with you that the word secular exactly translates against or along the lines of Dharma Nirapeksha or not, because they have interpreted Dharma Nirapeksha in their own way, and we have interpreted secularism, and then we wanted this and that. I don't know whether that's right. I think we have to interpret the way they had intended to interpret.
Can you take a break, and can we ask some others?
That's it.
Okay, did you have your questions directed to anyone? I mean, even I could answer that.
Yeah, you could.
With a PhD in Persian history.
Okay.
Right. No, because I do have something to say about the whole idea of things getting lost in translation. And because at some level, it's a very important point. At another level, I don't think any of us here is in denial of the fact that, like all languages, English is also a finite language with a vocabulary that is not often able to capture ideas, concepts, categories, practices that are not sort of, you know, easily identified with the lexicon of the very wide-angled English, you know, cathedral. But are there any other questions? Would you like to ask, please, madam? And then you.
Hi, I'm Alina Sala, graduate student at the University of Sheffield.
Yeah. Is your question directed to anyone?
It's kind of open question.
That's all right. Go ahead.
So I was just wondering, listening to all the debates about how the constitution is promulgated by the majority. So we kind of have the fact and data on one side, representation of diverse people and all those things and all the achievements. Again, we also have the people who are still asking for issues of discrimination, gender equality, women's citizenship. So my question is, how does this kind of social values and cultural practices, like Ms. Marie has mentioned, affects and influence or sometimes hinders our access to those political rights that are enshrined in written and institutionalized?
Yeah, I get it. Okay. And you, please.
First of all, thanks for organizing this program. And I totally agree with Dr. Suvedi. He represented the views of Nepali people, not as a government official, but he represented as a Nepali people. His voice is the true voice of Nepali people. Mm-hmm. I would like to add this, and I would like to congratulate for representing in such a good way. I'm totally impressed. And yeah, it's very true. Like, I'm speaking as Nepali people. It's not only like his government official. So, and the next question I would like to ask is regarding the theme. We have talked from Nepal, from Hindu kingdom to secular state.
Mm-hmm.
We have just talked about the introduction portion.
Mm-hmm.
We throughout the discussions, we didn't talk about why. Why from Hindu kingdom to secular state? I would like to put this conversation to beyond 100, 200 years ago. So how did the society change? We need to think in that aspect as well. Because if you think of the, like we said, the Marxism or whatever we think, I think if we see the Marxism, we need to think of our sacred text as well. We are just talking about the constitutions which are just promulgated 50, 60 years ago. What about our constitutions? Like, I mean, our sacred text books, we are not talking about that. It really represents the values, our scientific things, you know, which we have from thousands of years. So what I mean is, from Hindu kingdom to secular state, in this like 100, 200 years, we have destroyed the values. But before that, we were truly scientific.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were the concept of caste, whatever we are saying, it was based on the basis of our work, not on the basis of blood. It's
sure.
Nothing written in our books. I was totally...
Okay, what's your question?
My question is, there is lacking just the why aspect.
Okay, yeah. I mean, a topic can only capture that much. But let me answer your question first. Because it also ties up with something that some of the other panelists had said, and I said it very briefly in passing. The reason we are having this discussion, there's a very clearly thought-out reason for it, and there's a reason why it is articulated in the way in which it is that this may well be a personal trait of mine, but because I have had a role in determining it. It was not my decision alone, but I have had a role in it. The first thing is that, which some of the speakers also said, is that we were interested in the concept of secularism not because it was or was not an issue at any particular point in time when the Constitution was introduced. Okay? What we were interested in was the very fact that the concept or the category had been introduced in later recension of the Constitution, and how we could either discuss or imagine it playing out, as Sondra said, about, you know, how we could see that. That's one thing, just by way of explanation, not by way of justification. Your point is well made as far as the title is concerned, but like all titles, it doesn't intend to capture everything. Okay? Because I think this conversation in itself is important, as are all conversations. Okay? Whether What Nepal is today goes back only 200 or 250 years, and prior to those 200 and 250 years, it was a very different system or society, and it was more scientific or less scientific, or I could go on. But it is a very, very debatable topic. I'm not entirely sure I agree with you. Okay. But it is debatable. But that is for another context. Okay. In other words, what I'm saying is this topic is finite, like all topics are, and therefore it will be useful if we keep our discussion within this. This is not to suggest that it is a comprehensive or a complete topic, either about secularism or about the constitution or about Nepal. Yeah? Is that fine? Did any of you want to... can we just go through these questions, especially, you know, the ladies' questions? Marie, would you like to...
Oh, yes, and Michael also had a question
for
me, so maybe I will start. I will be very short. So you asked me whether the Maoist had an impact and still have. I think my talk was to say that they had an impact during the revolutionary decade, and that afterwards, when they became a mainstream political party, of course they had, but not so much on the social secularism I was interested in speaking of. Yet I think they had a lasting impact in really destroying the legitimacy of what we can call religious discrimination, which no one now would accept to consider as valid, even though still some people would not invite Dalit to speak to dinner. Yet they find other legitimation for this distance, saying that they are less clean and so, but they would not speak in terms of impurity. So I think they have really also educated and influenced a lot rural people, which the law have not done, because as you know, since 1962 Nepalese are equal in front of the law, but people did not understand that it also meant that they had to be equal between themselves. So the notion of equality was not really present in rural Nepal, and maybe it is something which is growing now, not only through the influence of the Maoists, but also through migration, where they are all treated equally and so on, and also the contact with other type of social organization, which are changing their own ideas. But so I think the too strong focus on the law, on the constitution, is also, well, it's very important and interesting, but it can be misleading, because for more than 50 years during the Panchayat time, and even before the so-called democratic Nepal, caste discrimination was very, very strong in Nepal. So you have to take this also into account.
David, did you want to take...
I want to hear more from the people who've come. We've got so many people here.
Okay, I have a question which is born from ignorance. Do government forms in Nepal require citizens to identify religion?
No,
they don't.
The census does.
The census does.
And is it possible to identify oneself as an atheist?
In the latest census, I think, yes. I think that's right. Non-religious is an option. I think it was for the first time introduced in 2011.
Is it non-religion or is it atheism?
It's not atheism.
No religion.
Okay.
And new religions also appeared.
Okay. Solga or Mala, did you want to take up any sort of questions? Yeah?
Okay. Like,
yeah. Do you want to go first, Solga?
Right. I just wanted to answer Mike's question about whether the constitution actually ever defined the status of the Hindu kingdom. Yes, it did. His Excellency, the ambassador, is absolutely correct. It was the 1962 and 1990 The interesting thing about 1990 is that there was a huge debate between the constitution makers about that.
The comma.
That came later. That was already in the later stage in which the constitution was finalized by the cabinet committee. But in the commission itself, the first version of the constitution was silent on the issue of religion. Then it was introduced at that level, and then in the revision by the three cabinet committee. Three members of the cabinet committee. They
led by former minister Nilambara Acharya.
Yes, absolutely. They inserted a comma, so the definition was Hindu monarchical kingdom. And the way in which it was framed was that it only referred to monarchical, and then it was revised so that it would define kingdom. And I wanted to answer the gentleman's question about why do we focus on constitutions. Well, I'm a lawyer, so you know that's where you're getting for me. aside from that, and I think you raised a very good point about questions of national ownership. And if you look at the United Nations guideline for constitution making, which has been in force, actually national ownership is really what's being prioritized. You have also one of the six elements is also respect for international law. But in my view and in my experience of, as a comparative constitutional lawyer, national ownership is what really is being prioritized. So.
I did first want to say, I wasn't arguing
that I have already accepted.
Yes. but I take your point. And I think it is important not to overstate the influence of certain parties in India pushing, or the transnational organizations like the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, etc. But you know, in response to Mike's question about the direction of travel, this is where I think for Nepal to stand on its own two feet, exactly with the characterization you have given it, Your Excellency, as far as a national history of inclusiveness, diversity. You were also speaking, the young man here was also speaking about a very traditional culture as unique, diverse, coexisting, standing on Nepal's history as inclusive and multiple, could, I hope, resist any pressures from south of the border, or indeed globally, for majoritarian politics, or for politics that are defined around the category of religion as primary, as a primary way of identifying as a nation. This is where Nepali strengths could really see it through. But it will require a certain kind of consciousness of Nepali history as having embraced that to the extent that it has, because the regional and the global forces are challenging it. Luckily, Nepal has a good history of standing up for its own values. And if those are the values, I would love to see that happening. Of course, you're absolutely right. A constitution is a reflection of social mores, but it does play out, as Mara has indicated and as others have indicated, in courts. And if gotten into the wrong hands, as it were, I mean, it's a public document, if it could be used to push these majoritarian party politics to the negative, especially with the use of something like Sanatan, which is, of course, the way it's the way Hindu fundamentalist party, or right-wing parties use it in India, right? Sanatan Dharma. So there's a resonance there, which we have to resist.
Okay. Well, I had a question which was actually for you, and I had it highlighted, which was that, you know, you made this very interesting point about defining nation through history. And I say this from the perspective of being a student of history myself. And the identification, as Marie was saying, of Hindus as not having a church or not having a revealed book, it's a very, very old identification in sources. I read in Persian, for those of you who know Persian, it actually describes Hindus as, you know, na peygamberi bud, without a peygamber, without a prophet, na kitab-e manzil, no book of destination, so no revealed book, you know, defines the fluidity of that group of people. Groups see that as a strength, and those who probably don't. But what is very interesting also in what the ambassador said is that a lot of this, what the young man here said, a lot of this is riding on a certain conception, certain understanding of history. And I think a very important point to think about, no one needs to reply to, but think about, is who then become the interpreters of history? Because a lot of historical knowledge is disciplinary, just by the nature, the manner in which society is organized. A lot of it is imbibed. The worst part, my greatest despair of being a historian, is that almost everyone who claims a right to appeal to history to make contemporary arguments is not a trained historian. Right? So it's mostly non-historians who appeal to a certain idea of history and then make an argument. But so, yes, it's very important that if the historical consciousness is one of tolerance and inclusivity and multiculturalism and respect and practice as opposed to structure, religion, etc., it's equally important to be able to continuously perpetuate and communicate it through the generations, rather than having a derivative discourse about an idea or an identity of history. Shall we take another round of...
I do feel I have to respond to that. I'm sorry. Before we get all Pollyanna-ish about how wonderful and inclusive Nepal is, I'm sorry. I mean, it's partly influenced by the fact that my PhD was about Buddhists in Nepal. Mm. They thought that this whole panchayat stuff about inclusivity and tolerance was deeply oppressive, and it was actually a front for, you know, suppressing Buddhists, appropriating the fact that the Buddha was born in Nepal and using it for Hindu dominance, taking all, you know, they felt deeply oppressed by this. And if you look at the opinion polls, absolutely clear, you know, both before and after Nepal was declared a secular state, if you ask people, you know, would you like Nepal to be a Hindu state, there are big majorities among Khas Aryas, and that falls massively among Janajati people. So, I mean, there's a clear cultural divide there, and it's, you know, I mean, this strong, this idea of tolerance and inclusivity is important, but the fact is it hides kind of all kinds of structural discrimination and disadvantage against non-Khas Arya people, and that is a fact, and you only have to talk to them to find that out. And insofar as people refuse to talk about that, then they're in denial about the kind of deepest problem that Nepal faces. So I'm sorry, before we get too carried away.
No, I agree completely. I mean, I was speaking from the disciplinary perspective, but I think that's absolutely true. I think there's no denial of differences and cracks within any monolith. Mm. Shall we take another round?
I wanted to add that please. On the other hand, it could have been seen that this Hindu label as something inclusive for the Madhishi, who are, like the Pali, in majority Hindu. So,
right. It was up to a point. Yes.
Okay. So you raised your hand first.
Yeah, my name is Ian Martin. I was in Nepal in the United Nations in 2005 and 2009. I followed very closely the draft of the interim constitution. We're looking closely at these words, and it's a very interesting discussion, but nobody said anything about how they got in there. Somewhere between the Lord and the Public People and the words of the Constitution, there was a process that I'm interested to ask anyone who knows what discussion took place around the drafting. Did everybody agree? Were there disagreements? Was it a compromise? Who took what position on it? Could we have information if anybody has
which words was it?
Sanatani.
Sanatani. So these words, right? Yes. So all the words, yeah. So the words we've been discussing. Okay. Can we just quickly take a few more questions, ma'am? You after that, yeah. Could you just introduce yourself?
My name is Anupama, and I'm a student at the LSE in international relations. So I wanted to know that there was a discussion about the pluralistic, legalistic ethos versus the right-wing majoritarianism that exists. And I'm sure that, I would take that as an Indian context as well. Mm-hmm. But how does, with this coming of the constitution, how does Nepal want to resolve its own inherent contradictions that exist within society? Like, does it see this as an opportunity to actually, reduce the gap that exists within these two fields of thought or schools of thought? So how does it plan to do that?
Okay, so you.
Oh, yeah. So my name is Oliver Spitzer-Tresta. I was one of the annoying people in the Constituent Assembly who was there as an international lawyer trying to get the MPs to change the draft. I think one thing that is missing in the, or one thing that you have to think about when you're considering this shift, and I've worked in a lot of Asian countries, and I would agree that generally speaking, Nepali people are far more tolerant than people in other countries in the region. I would totally agree. What I would not agree with is that this government and the state is tolerant. Mm. I think that the new NGO and INGO law that's coming forth now, which uses the same language as we were discussing back in the Constituent Assembly at the time around harmonisation, is an example of this, because when Nepali people think about tolerance, they think about it in a positive way. But when the state talks about tolerance through the use of the language of harmonisation, it means it in a negative way. So when the state uses the phrase harmonisation, it's stopping people from doing things. But tolerance is about facilitating them, empowering them to do it. And I think that's the difference, is that the state doesn't do that at all. It's all about negative obligations, negative crackdowns. It doesn't reflect the people's tolerance.
Okay, thanks. Should we take these three, because
yes,
otherwise they become...
Oh.
Yeah, and then we go through another round. Did you want to say something about the inclusion of the words?
Yeah, I mean, maybe somebody else in this room does know. I mean, just to go back to the discussion, Sanatan definitely is significant as the replacement of Parapurvakar, because of the whole history of it in India right back to the 19th century. So that is a flag. Clearly, a constitution is a compromise. It's a constitutional document. You have a whole load of people in a room and in committee rooms, and you know that's how you ended up with this spashtikaran, this explanation, the way it is, pushing together to satisfy different people. And there are lots of other places in the constitution where you can see this process of bargaining behind the words. I had a long chat with Minendra Rizal, who was a minister of information, just before the constitution was confirmed. His opinion, he thought that the Dharma Nirpeksha was going to be taken out altogether. He thought that that it was going to be replaced by freedom of religion. And a lot of other people thought that too. So clearly there was a kind of exchange. Freedom of religion went in, but Dharma Nirpeksha stayed there as well. And then maybe, you know, accepting Sanatan was part of, replacing Parapurvakar with Sanatan was part of the deal. I don't know. But one can imagine that that's how it was done.
Did anyone want to add to the inclusion of words, categories?
Can I add something?
Yeah, just one sec. Anyone, any of the speakers?
Well, I just wanted to add something to David's answer. I think it's significant that in Nepal, no records were kept of Constituent Assembly debates as late as the proceedings between 2008 and 2015.
Okay.
No official record.
Okay. Was your question? Okay, we'll just come to you, sir. No, did you direct it to someone in particular?
I mean, David's already spoken to it a little bit. I don't want to project from the Indian case on. And I think, I mean, to be honest, I think this is what's in process now. I haven't done fieldwork in Nepal of late, so I don't want to speak about what's happening on the ground. But this obviously is, as David's indicated, a kind of compromise at the constitutional level. And then the question is, to what extent does this become institutionalized or structuralized? I mean, and I can't say from personal knowledge at this moment in time. I don't want to mislead you.
One second. Did anyone want to speak on the gentleman's question of the difference between cultures of tolerance at the level of people and citizens versus state?
I think that's a very pertinent observation. I think it's probably right. I think the state, well, specifically K.P. Sharma Oli, has managed to... He's ridden the wave of Hill nationalism, for sure, partly in response to the blockade. He's also incorporated a little bit, not a lot, but that kind of Hindu nationalism encouraged by... the RPP and so on. He's incorporated a little bit of that. How far he will go, I don't know. On that.
Briefly. In fact, I didn't want to issue, but it's directly related to the comment. So I can't agree with you because, yes, I think it's your personal observation, but the government, how it comes, is from the people. David mentioned about Right Honourable K.P. Woolley, he is also elected from a constituency, from a popular vote. He became parliament member and he became prime minister. But I must say, Mr. Woolley's nationalism is not, I must mention it, related to Hindu nationalism. Mm. That I must mention. And Nepalese government, although there are some limitation of the rules and laws that I mentioned earlier also, but there is no interpretation like people's interpret harmonization or tolerance in one way or government interprets another way. It is not. It's not. Maybe your personal observation. Thank you.
Okay. Did you want to add anything, Mike? To any of the things that
you said? No, I was just thinking about going back to Ian's question about the actual kind of mechanics of which words went in and which didn't. I think it's important to remember that this was a very fast-track process, and it began really in the early June of 2015, and the constitution was promulgated in September 20th, 2015. So it was a very tight process, and I think it was a pretty intensive, as David suggests, you know, closed-door political negotiation, which did not perhaps involve the wider membership of the CA in the same way that it had before that process commenced. So this is a negotiated constitution, I would say, you know, at least the finer points of it, when a lot of the groundwork had already been done in the CA before the earthquake. There were some very key issues, and particularly the federal structure was one that had to be hammered out over the summer of 2015, and that was a political debate between party leaders rather more than the wider CA.
Also, could I just add, last year here at the centre we did two exhibitions on the Pakistan and Indian constitutions because of 70 years of Pakistan and 70 years of India, etc. And I spent a lot of time studying the making of the constitutions because I was looking at what I could display in terms of objects. And it can be said with some fairness that the most interesting, the most complicated, and at a certain level, the most authoritarian actions within meetings of constituent assembly debates have to do with discussions surrounding federalism. Because it is about allocation. And India's is understandably the most complex because of size, etc. You had a question.
I'm Ivan. I'm from the Department of Anthropology upstairs. Can I ask two questions?
Yes.
Okay, one is brief, which is we heard mention of the court in the interpretation, which is yet to come. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know what kind of cases we expect to see in front of the court in which this definition might be important, and what predictions you make as to what interpretation might come. I also don't know whether this sets precedent or not in the Nepali case, and would like to know how determining whatever case we're about to see will be for the future. So that's a legal question. My other question is not so much about secularism as it is about this ban on conversion or ban on proselytizing, which I encountered in the field, which I didn't know before I was in the field in Nepal, working with Nepal. Which I find very curious, and I wonder how that fits into the notion of secularism and whether it fits in more specifically in a South Asian pluralistic definition of secularism or not, whether it's specific to Nepal or not. I'm particularly worried about it because there is this discourse in Nepal that, you know, Dalits are more likely to convert to Christianity. That's something that you encounter all the time, that the more oppressed or the more, you know, that certain communities are more likely to convert. So I do wonder whether, intentionally or not, this ban doesn't target every community at the same level, and if it doesn't, how that is justified legally.
I have a rider to that, and then I'll come to you. You have a question, Gemma. Is that, this is for both Mara and for Sandra, is that it rides on Ivan's question, because when I was hearing it, I was thinking, and I've only just recently read around the Nepal Constitution for today's event, is that isn't, rather than using the word conversion, isn't it that wanting to change one's religion should be a form of freedom? I mean, should that not be a constitutional?
You can change, but you,
can't. But you can't convert. Is that the difference?
You can convert, but you can't Quran.
It's the Quran cause right. If you use the Quran, then it means that you're encouraging somebody else to convert. So you can't encourage anybody else to convert. But if they convert of their own free will, then it's perfectly legal.
Then it's legal.
But it's okay. Very, of course, actually separating what has happened in any particular instance. Is the police to interpret.
Indeed, I mean, I'm sure you'll find very dangerous examples of what might happen, you know, very close to Nepal's home. There was someone here who'd raised their hand. I'll come to you. One of you? Yeah. You wanted to ask a question?
Yeah.
Yes. Go ahead, please.
This is Resham, all the way from Nepal. Mm-hmm. I'm in Holland, in Vasily. A little bit of background. First one is happened with the name, right? Second lady, please.
Sandra.
Yeah. While talking about this multi-pluralism or something like that, I think it's not possible here in this debate, but we have to think a little bit further, thinking about Hinduism first. Like, what's the difference between Hindu philosophy and other philosophy? Hindu research is like something different than other religion, I think. So, it's a truth seeker and truth follower. That's how multiple gods are there, Baptist and many Hindu. Eshut is a good seeker, everyone seeks the truth. And other religions, everyone is good followers, so they follow something else. Yeah. So basically, I don't afraid with being a Nepali with this whatever extreme party, rightist or something going in India, that you never can interest in the society more than this one. That's what I can guarantee. Yeah? That's, all the forces are there. Other truth seeking forces are there. So they each other counterbalance it. We need to be ourselves more than this tolerance, I think, or resilience, I think. That's how we have to think philosophically, that deep down, your pluralism or secularism comes beyond that one. I think we have to think that way about Nepalese society. And the one, I'm this personality, you know, more than me about Nepal. And so basically, nothing works like all the part of the globe in Nepal. Nothing works. Nothing works like part of the world. Communism never works like other part of the world. Yeah? Everyone should appreciate it or agree it. Because this is a typically different society, right? From it's a very typical society. Outsiders, basically, I think you guys just go and do research based on some other references. It looks like a very liquid society, but to me, it looks like a very solid society. Yeah? And that's how what I think about Nepal is like nothing works like Marxism, because Marxists are living there. Nothing works like a religious thing, Hindus or something like that. So, to me, throughout my life, I never wrote to my mind, which is my religion. That's the structure there, right, from the BBC to something else. And there is not a single document where I have to explore about my religion.
Okay, can you just say what your question is, because there's some others. Yeah.
That's how. This religious thing is like more in our constitution. That's literally scoping this. Just last week, I was in Nepal and we were trying to see what's the problem of Nepal, in terms of political chaperones. Is this Hindu kingdom or secularism, whatever, new constitution is really leading the society for the stable society or not? We are leading 11 countries, and we live in Nepal. Nepal is better than any other one. So why don't you take it as an example, and instead of digging down something like that, why don't we take it as a post example of better than others? We found out of the 11 critically transitional countries globally, we found ours is going better than others. Yeah? So in that sense, I think this kingdom was the problem, not the Hindu kingdom. That's the debate, a little bit.
So I've got one of your questions.
Problem. That's how this is a Hindu kingdom and kingdom we have to separate. And that's how. What I think is, do you guys really, David and Hot, and do you two giant personalities think that this constitution is not going to work comfortable? Or is really can, our aspiration or our expectation or our, is going to work or not? If it's seriously a problem there to deliver whatever our targets are there, or development targets, everything is prosperity now, do you guys really think that it's not going to work? If we not, then where is the pinpoint? Where is the problem? What this Nepali type of, secularism?
Okay. Okay,
you know,
we've got it.
There. Please stop, you know.
Okay, okay. Can I just say a couple of things? Because one of the things you began with saying is very close to home. This is my 20th year in England. Okay? I'm also going to turn 50 this year. Okay? No, what I'm going to say to you is that one of the very interesting things is how my perspective of, you know, until I came to England, no one ever asked me an identity question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are you or what is it? And one of the things I have learned is how being on the outside and looking at yourself can be a very, very interesting experience, a self-experience, unrelated to anyone else, including your own country people or, you know, etc. It's interesting because it gives you multiple perspectives at the same time. Okay, I agree with you completely that there's a difference between Hindu and kingdom. I agree with you completely, simply because I come from a background of studying politics and governance. My PhD is on inclusive governance, okay? So I agree with you completely on that. The rest of the questions, I will let them answer. Before that, Shema.
Right. Hi, thanks for the talk. My name is Shema. I work here at the South Asia Center. My question is a long comment, but essentially it's about, I'd like each of you guys to, you know, tell me what you think about the conversion of religion and public political life. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's not just about pieces of paper, it's what people do, and what does that do to a society, you know, for all its claim about inclusivity and pluralism and da-da-da. So, when Nepal was a Hindu kingdom, the king was at the focal point of all major religious festivals, right? Every Ratu Matendranath, he'd come out, he'd show the poti of Ratu Matendranath. You know, so he was, I mean, of course, we didn't get to see the king all the time, but there he was holding the moti of Ratu Matendranath, and that did something for the society. So when the king, when the monarchy was abolished, there was a little bit of a moral panic within Kathmandu Valley about what was going to happen to all their rituals, because the king was at the center of it all, and he would say things like, may Lord Pashupatinath bless us all during his televised action. There was a very direct link, at least, an active direct link between the state, you know, the king himself, you know, the prosperity, the future and prosperity of Nepal, and the religion that people in a sense, day to day, you know, practiced or not practiced, believed or not believed. And then Nepal became, you know, somewhat of a, you know, secular state, you know, and even in the transition period, the president almost occupied the role of the king, you know. It was the president taking out the bhoti of Ratu Matendranath. And you're just like, what's going on? You know, so I just want to know what you guys think about this. You know, what do you guys think about this very, you know, this annual conversion of religion and public political life?
The previous president.
Okay, we'll come to you. Shall we start with Ivan's questions? Did you want to take on Ivan's question?
Yes, on the ban on conversion and where it comes from. I think it's actually a question of sequencing. Rather than starting with the constitution, one should look at the criminalization of the practice, which actually precedes any of the constitutional references. So I offer no guidance on the old Murukiyain, right? I can't read that, but Axel Nichols would be the person to ask that question. But on the 1953 Murukiyain, which is the current one, you still have a criminalization of proselytism. That links, I think, with Nilanjan's point, and I believe that the Nepali expression is dharma parivartan garaune, so it's a causative verb, to cause, to change someone's religion. So I think that's the practice that under law is forbidden and criminalized. In terms of cases, what have we seen so far? I think we've seen a number of cases. Also, I would have to ask you which court. So in terms of my own work, I look at the Supreme Court level. I think there's interesting litigation going on at district court level. So if you look at prosecutions, that's where they would take place. I don't know anyone who's doing work on that. But in terms of Supreme Court level, I think we have a number of cases which you've seen of religion, the Kumari. I think that links nicely to your point with regard to what's the role of the Kumari in legitimizing state authority, and I think that's been preserved. So I think we kind of, to put in Foucauldian terms, I think we're looking at a situation in which perhaps the king's head is not being cut off.
Mm-hmm.
I can just add quickly.
Yes, there is a similar resonance about proselytization in India, very much so. And I think it's punishable, actually, there as well, although I shouldn't say I'm not a constitutional lawyer. But it's definitely a significant trope, and I've even heard anecdotal evidence of people being planted, Westerners being planted with crosses so that they can be pointed as having proselytized. So it's actually used by groups who want to, and this is really the point, target foreigners, right? So it's an anti-foreign move more than a let's keep Dalits in their place move. Although I think your point about
and I
think that that's very interesting. Although I do think that's a relevant point. Although these same organizations in India, I should say, I don't know whether this is played out similarly in Nepal, has fought against its own representation as having denigrated Dalits. So we're keeping all castes, you know, so Hinduism is not negative to anybody. In fact, it is very inclusive. So it wouldn't be about keeping Dalits in their place as much as making sure foreigners don't come in to tweak things, and we keep Dalits on the same level anyway.
Okay, I should say my question was entirely from position of ignorance. I didn't know what the conversion thing meant. Did you want to take the question, the two of you, about where you think the Constitution is going to go looking forwards?
Well, I think the key major change that the Constitution has brought is the federal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that holds out risks and opportunities for Nepal. I mean, huge opportunities if it works well, if power is decentralized and you can see more local accountability, more locally focused development work and so on and so forth. So, I mean, it's very much too early to say whether the federal structure is going to work, because that depends very much, I think, on the extent to which power is actually devolved down to the provinces. But I would think it has considerable potential, so it's potentially a very good change. We have to see how it works.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think it is a great achievement. You know, people talked about decentralization before, and now it may actually. I mean, I think it will. I think it is going to happen, because nobody. I mean, I somehow doubt whether maybe, with the exception of Mara, I probably think nobody in this room has actually read the new constitution from cover to cover, and I think most Nepali politicians also haven't. They are learning by doing. They've been elected to these provincial assemblies, and actually several of them had to be slapped down quite quickly because they started, doing things that were actually not in their power to do, and the central government had to sort of very quickly move to say, hang on, you're not allowed to do that. So, and some of the local mayors did the same. So I think the possibilities are great. There are a couple of issues hanging over. You know, there are certain issues on which Madheshis still feel, even though they're participating, which I think is great, and they're fully participating, as the ambassador said. They voted, their representatives are there. Nonetheless, that doesn't change the fact that they still feel deeply resentful at certain quite prejudicial clauses in the Constitution, which they feel deny them proportionate representation. And then there's also the gender issue. The kind of the people feel that really there are too many clauses in the Constitution which just basically mean that women do not have the same rights as men. And there's a quite difficult to disentangle. But I think these will have to be faced in the long term. So in other words, the Constitution gives various rights to all kinds of people: rights to work, rights to this, rights to land, rights to inheritance. Some of which contradict each other. You know, one thing says you're absolutely not allowed to discriminate on the grounds of gender, and yet another clause does precisely that. So these things will have to be faced up to, and it will require the Supreme Court to take various decisions about how to interpret the Constitution with all these multiple different clauses. If I could just answer the Shimi's question about the ritual.
Yeah. Before that, can I just ask, because this was related, is the Supreme Court the arbiter for the Constitution? So if someone feels discriminated and wants to appeal, is it the Supreme Court that the citizen goes to?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what happens?
That is the appellate body in judiciary.
They might go to a lower body first, no?
They can go to Supreme Court also. Mm.
Yeah.
So if it's a fundamental right, they can go directly to... So if someone stops you from eating, then you can go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Is that what...
Public interest litigation from India.
Sorry?
Just borrow public interest litigation.
You have the same thing as in India, the PIL.
So you can have a public law remedy, both at high court level now and at Supreme Court level.
Right.
And I think they're introducing socioeconomic rights litigation at district court level.
Right. Okay, so there are certain instances in which you can go directly, and then other. Okay, fine, so it works more or less. You wanted to say something?
I wanted to just answer the question about ritual. You're absolutely right. There's a whole book about this by Anne Mocker called Demoting Vishnu, which I strongly recommend to you, which is all about precisely how did the change happen from, I mean, actually everything we're discussing from Hindu kingdom to secular state. And her argument is actually ritual is absolutely crucial to this whole